Hi, this is Chris Simpson from the Stage Dev Podcast. Welcome to a run of four episodes that we're dropping pretty much back to back. We've got Spike Edney, who's been in Queen for 35 years, who played Live Aid. He was on stage at Live Aid with Queen during that legendary performance. We've got Tim Stafell as well, who was the lead singer in Roger Taylor and Brian May's band, who decided to leave. And then Freddie Mercury stepped in, and that's a really interesting chat about his well-being around that, the envy he talks about over the years after he left that band. And seeing Queen go on to be who they became. A really interesting episode. We've got YC from Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, who literally is on stage right now supporting U2 in Auckland as I record this, and Fraser from one of the coolest bands on the planet, Jungle. And please press subscribe so you can listen to all episodes. Get in touch to say hello. We love to hear from you and where you're listening from. So go to our Facebook and Twitter pages. It's the Stage Left Podcast is what you want to be looking for. Stage Left is all one word. Also go onto our Instagram, where you'll see behind-the-scenes photos of every episode. We've a private dinner with Mo Pleasure of Michael Jackson's band in our lounge in London on the 22nd of December. It's a five-course meal. You're going to be sat with Mo, and he's going to play a live performance right in front of you. He's played with everyone, even at the White House at Barack Obama's request. So, hope you enjoy the episode. Here we go. Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. The podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Go to stageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who just discuss in detail the writing, recording and performing processes with the likes of Radiohead, Guns N' Roses, Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, The Beatles, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Oasis, Morrissey, Alanis Morissette, The 1975, Bob Dylan and Kraftwerk. Today we're joined by a true legend of modern popular music, a man whose day job is playing stadiums and arenas, a man who's played with Stevie Wonder, the Rolling Stones, and guitar and keyboards for over 35 years in Queen, Spike Edney. Today we'll be learning exactly what Spike's role entails as a musical director in Queen, what it was like playing with Stevie Wonder and the Rolling Stones, how comes he didn't get a camera shot when playing Freddie Mercury's grand piano at a Live Aid during Crazy Little Thing Called Love, how vocoders work, his thoughts on hologram gigs, how he helped coordinate the incredible bill of Freddie's tribute gig, and if it's true he was a matchmaker of the century by being the person who asked Queen to play Live Aid on Bob Geldof's behalf. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than Spike Edney. Thanks for joining today, Spike. How is it going?
Well, it's going, and I'm very grateful for it.
that's a good start. Now, a few years ago, you said that you remembered watching Queen on TV and thinking, God, what does it take to be in a big band like that? What does it take?
Yeah, it wasn't TV. I think it would have been Top of the Pops, I guess, but I think it was listening to them when they had a quite infamous broadcast. I think it was either Christmas or New Year's Eve at Hammersmith Odeon, which may have been 1975, I'm not quite sure. But I remember hearing them and the buzz around them at the time of Bohemian Rhapsody, which literally swept across the UK that Christmas. It was so all-encompassing in a way, because they were on Top of the Pops every week with that video, and the video was a brand new concept. We'd never seen anything like that. The record, of course, was a complete original piece in all its glory. So the British public bought into it big time. So they were everywhere. Every shop you went into, nearly everything on TV was about that song. And I thought, not since really Beatlemania took over the UK had there been anything like that. I mean, we had a bit of nonsense with the Osmonds and Bay City Rollers, but that was teeny bop hysteria. This was something else. This was grown-ups liked this music, and it was okay. It wasn't dismissed as being nonsense. My mum and dad, who were quite cool anyway, they got it straight away, why it was so good and why it was so different. So for me, and I have to admit this, it was pure jealousy that the fact that they'd managed to touch the nerve of public consciousness with something that was utterly original and uncompromising. And for me, I thought, well, here I am chasing around like a thousand other people in a thousand other bands looking for that way in, what was always seemed to be a very crowded marketplace in terms of bands looking for record deals and stuff like that. So we were all fighting to get noticed, and Queen, through their sort of bravado and self-belief, just cracked it in such a way that we could all just stand back and go, wow, you know, here's something really new. Real life, is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies.
And you personally, to be, you know, you went from watching and thinking, oh, what does it take to be in a big band like that? And now you've been in that band for 35 years. Aside from the things that often people say, which is a load of hard work and a little bit of luck, what are the things it takes to be in a band like that for 35 years?
Well, I think that's true, a load of hard work. Well, they say it's 10,000 hours before you could really say you've mastered something. I don't know if that's true or not. Yeah, other things. A massive amount of talent is very useful. Although you don't necessarily have to be talented to get any kind of success in this business, as we see on TV, as people with not much talent get access to fame and fortune for 5 minutes. Talent, dedication. You need to be fairly thick-skinned, because you will probably come up against a negative force for a long time before you actually break through.
So, and what does that look like, that negative force?
Well, it's like people, I think if you saw the movie, having record companies tell you that you cannot get a record played unless it's 2.5 minutes long, which really was the law. Don't even bother to give me a record, anything that's longer than 3 minutes, they used to say. And they always used to have a rule, say, get to the chorus quick. Don't bore us, get to the chorus. So if you followed all these rules, that's what homogenizes music. Because if you follow any kind of trend, I mean, like today, you hear so many records that sound the same because they're all using the latest plugin and the latest production technique. As soon as somebody gets a hit, whatever they used becomes the Bible, and you get everybody jumping on it. Well, if it's already a hit, then don't touch it, leave it alone. Go somewhere else and look for something else to do, because you're already a follower, not a leader. And for any real sort of success, long-lasting success, it's better to be a leader than a follower.
What makes a great leader?
If you're talking about bands and music, yep, originality and talent are the two things you cannot do without, and they are the most difficult things to find. You can see young people coming up with amazing talent. I mean, I know some youngsters, there's a young chap that we've sort of given some stage time to, Kyan, who's a young artist who's exceptionally talented. But he's looking for that original thing that's going to make him stand out, because of it's such a crowded place. You know, anybody can make a record. Well, not a record, but anybody could get their music up online. Which means, how do you stand out from the 10,000 other people out there whose music may be valid, maybe not, but record companies aren't there to promote you like they once were, and the radio doesn't promote you like it used to. The world has changed. Everybody's promoting themselves, and you've got to get your head above the parapet. Difficult, very difficult.
A gig day, a concert day with Queen, obviously a huge production. What do you need in place personally that you feel confident going on stage, obviously as musical director as well, that you feel confident and happy?
Correct you about that. The musical director thing is a bit of a misnomer, because in the true sense of the word, a musical director will tell everybody what to do, what to play, and when to play it. So that's the basic.
Can't
now,
see that.
I don't tell Queen what to do. They don't need me to tell them what to do. What they need me for is to remind them what they did before and what are we doing now. Over a career that's lasted, for them, over 40 years, and for me, 35 plus years with them, their music has gone through so many changes and upgrades. So if you hear a version of any one of their songs, well, apart from Bohemian Rhapsody, well, maybe even that, from 1975 to the version that you hear on stage now, There have been tweaks and there have been changes, there have been edits. We've done short versions for certain shows, we've done long versions for shows. And so when we look at each other and say, okay, now we're going to play It's a Kind of Magic, and then the next question will be, well, which version are we going to play? You know, what have we done to it? And it's my job to remember, and fortunately, I'm quite good at that. So I will say, well, actually, we cut it after the second chorus and we jumped to this bit and we edited out that bit. And when we got to the end, we added a guitar solo, or we took a guitar solo away, or something like that. So, and then they might say, and what harmonies did we sing? You know, and of course, I'll have that. So think of me as a sort of court stenographer. You know, I'm the guy that makes all the notes. And it's really interesting because, yeah, a couple of weeks ago, somebody gave me this article by Chuck Lavelle, who's been the inverted commas musical director for the Rolling Stones for the past 25, 30 years or whatever. And he says the same thing. He doesn't tell the Rolling Stones how to play Satisfaction or whatever. He's just a keeper of the records to say there are 10 versions of Satisfaction that the Rolling Stones have played over the years. And so they then decide which version they're going to do, or are we going to do something new? For example, let's say a couple of years back, Queen did rock, the Big Ben Rocks.
Oh, yeah, New Year's Eve thing. Yeah.
Well, that was all about working to a stopwatch so that we would stop just before midnight and then we could carry on just after. Now, you don't know how nerve-wracking it is to know that you are live, playing live, and the watch is ticking, the hands are going around, and you know that you're in the middle of a certain song and you want to finish on another song. So at a certain point in the proceedings, at about quarter two, I'd made copious notes about where we needed to be in order to get so that we didn't finish too soon or too late.
So
I had all these signs going on, and when we're in the middle of whatever it was, crazy little thing called love, there was a certain point where everybody knew they'd had to look at me, and I would give them the sign for either wick, cutting it, you know, the old cross the neck job, or we're rolling on, we've got longer to go. And of course, to be honest, I was crapping myself because it was all down to me. If it's a success, everybody shares the glory. Yeah. If it's a failure, it's my fault. So that's really what I do. I sort of help organise when things need to be changed, or, well, when we start a production, a new production, and we have to look at a set list, then I'll probably come up with a ground zero idea. And I say, why don't we start with this and go through and do that? And they'll all throw darts at me and say, don't be stupid, that's horrible. And then we talk about it for a week, then we end up doing that normally.
Yes. What's the most radical idea that you've come up with that they've gone no?
Oh, most radical idea that they've gone no. Oh, I might have just done something stupid like saying, why don't we open with We Will Rock You, We Are the Champions? Which, of course, they've closed with for 35
of course,
years.
Cool. And in regards to you feeling confident on stage, I mean, you just talked about, you know, an occasion where you felt like you're crapping yourself. What do you feel like you need to be? What's in your mix, if you like, in your monitors that you think, okay, I'm in the zone and I'm just happy? What's the common denominator for good gigs from that perspective?
Well, having grown up in the era of pub gigs, and even before monitor systems, I remember when the first monitor system came out and how shocking it was to be able to hear yourself.
Because, shocking in what way?
Well, shocking is we never had. You had to self-monitor on stage up until the sort of early 70s, and I've been playing live in bands from about 67 as a schoolboy and then as a teenager. And you self-balance on stage. You turn your I was playing bass at the time, I think, those days. You would turn up your instrument so that you could hear it, but not too loud that you couldn't hear what the other guys were doing, because you needed to be able to lock in to the drummer. Of course, guitarists didn't care about that. They used to just turn it up full and play all over everything anyway. That was the general thing. And then when monitors came out, all of a sudden, it made the most difference, of course, to vocalists, because they didn't have to screech and shout. I mean, all the great big powerful voices that were in the 60s and 70s, you could now have people that sang softly working on stage. The early systems were very crude, but it was an improvement. But I was used to not having anything, so I don't need much. Now, the younger people I work with have to have every single thing in their in-ears, including the reverbs on the hi-hat and all this other nonsense. Now, for me, that would be a nightmare because you're hearing too much. Mm. The old school method is you need to hear the drummer so that you play in time. You need to hear the singer so that you know that you're playing the right part, because there's this old-fashioned rule that singers invariably forget words, get carried away. It happens all the time. And we'll come in on a chorus or the wrong verse or jump into the middle eight. And if you've got your wits about you and you hear that, then you should follow the singer. Mm. You should not make the singer retract, because it will turn into a train wreck. Yeah, but if he goes wrong and you hear it and you go with him, then invariably you'll get away with it. Mm. There are, if you use synced tracks, of course, you're in trouble, because you can't change that. So
do Queen use tracks?
No. Well, we never have, but we do use a little bit at the very beginning of the introduction of Radio Gaga. Now, I used to play that by Steam, which is like an arpeggiator thing, and we did it for many years. But you can't keep it up through the whole song because it will go awry. So we've compromised with that, and we've put that onto a track, and that runs all the way through the intro until the vocal starts. So once the vocal starts, it's done with. And that means we can... we actually extended the beginning where we needed to do that. And what was the reason? I think... it was a practical stage reason, because the song before used to be that Brian needed to go and change or something, or the singer had to go and change, and so we needed to stretch out the intro. And it just made sense that we would use this arpeggiator just to set the thing up and have a bit of a light show and whatever, and all of a sudden the vocals will come in and we're off and we're done with the track, and that's it. I have to say I'm not very keen on it, because I think it's... it sends the wrong kind of message, because we've been accused over the years. I think there was a review one time that said the show had suspiciously flawless backing vocals, implying we were using tracks. Roger was incandescent with rage that... the tracks were used to do backing vocals or anything
else. It's almost the biggest compliment in a way that they thought it was.
Well, yeah, and so the thing is, I think the only thing is that by using this little bit of trickery at the beginning of Radio Gaga, people might then think, well, if they're doing that, then what else?
They're doing the others.
Yeah, yeah, what else? But it's not. Well, I mean, we've got five good voices and me up there, and so we can do a fairly good job of making it sound realistic.
That I know you don't like not being described as musical director. Talk about on-stage communication and how you can... is it all visual cues that you do? I believe you don't have like a system that kind of you can communicate through monitors and stuff like that.
No.
So how do you go about... Is there an actual language that you're using?
Eyebrows. Eyebrows, yes and no. Nodding of the head. So there are certain points of the show where things can go wrong, where memories, and especially if you're doing edited versions of songs, let's say you've played a song the same way for years and years and years, then you've got to do a TV show, you've got to cut it down. That's when things can go wrong, because muscle memory kicks in. So I can say to everybody in rehearsal, okay, we're not doing verse 2, we're going straight to chorus 3. And we'll all nod and say, yes, we'll do that. You get on stage and I'm afraid the blindness sets in. So fortunately, both Roger and Adam are very good at checking in with me. So, and that's only a look. All they're going to do is look at me, and all I've got to do is raise my eyebrows and just nod gently that here we go. Or I just say, no, it's not happening. And in which case, stay where you are, keep going doing what you're doing. And it really, literally is that.
You said before that Freddie was shy and the inner performer was unleashed on stage. What are the intricate differences between your on-stage and off-stage persona?
Me?
Yeah. What side of you, Matt, perhaps is more prominent on stage than off stage?
Well, I get far more bad-tempered with people on stage when they don't pay attention. Especially in the SAS band, we have things, you know, when I say, now this is really important, pay attention, because at this point of the show, or this point of the song, we are going to do this, and you need to look at me and make sure that you are aware. And of course, we get to that point, and everybody's looking around, laughing, joking, off with the fairies. That's when the evil side of me comes out, because I think, you wankers, what's going on? And they're all laughing. And meanwhile, we train Rhett quite a lot with the SAS band.
I came to one of your last shows. It was absolutely amazing, the guests that you had on. But I believe you don't rehearse for that. Is that correct? Or not too many?
Not enough.
Right?
We don't rehearse enough.
Is that deliberate?
So you keep it, no. It's a case of expensive. Yeah. It costs a lot of money to get everybody together. So we have to do most of it in preparation. It used to be cassettes. I would choose what the songs were going to be for the upcoming show. And then back in the 80s, I had one of those high-speed cassette duplicators. Mm. I've still got it somewhere. So then I would have to make 30 cassettes and post them through the Royal Mail to people to learn, so that when they came, I don't have time for people to learn stuff at my expense. And I don't mean expense money wise, I mean my expense time wise in the rehearsal studio, because we have normally a show consists of 25 songs. We don't always play 25 songs, but we normally have prepared 25 songs so that we have a leeway. To do that from scratch takes an awful long time. So fortunately, the musicians in the SAS band know that they need to walk in knowing how the song goes. And not everybody reads. Some people read. Some people just make their own hieroglyphic notes. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as they've done it, so that when we get to that song, I can say, right, let's just play it through once for the song. We do. First chorus, solo, done. I said, right, now this is what we're going to do at the beginning. We're going to add this section. Or this is what we're going to do at the end. This is how it's going to finish. And that's what we learn, the top and tail. That's the new bit. And that's what I'm really concerned about. If there's an issue that we've all got the right chords, that sometimes we just... That's what the first run through is, to check that we were all playing a C instead of an A minor, or did we get the bass part right, or where do the horns come in? Do we like the horn part? No, we don't. We need to change that. That happens a lot, actually. When I hear something, it doesn't go very well. They say, well, that's what's on the record. And I say, yeah, well, it sucks. I'm not doing it. Yeah.
And SAS obviously stands for Spikes All Stars, and you get some amazing guests. You know, Roger Taylor rocked up and did Under Pressure and a couple other tunes, the last one. How last minute is that stuff? Are you planning quite in advance who's going to be performing and booking people in?
I always have a wish list.
Nice.
It depends on availability, of course. But that stuff can run right the way up to the last minute. And it depends. I don't like to do too many people that haven't done any rehearsal. That's why we tend to do warm-up gigs. Like this year, we're doing two nights at the Brook. Mm-hmm. And every day we will change the artists around, so that by the time we get to G Live, we will have played with everybody. And there may be somebody left that we haven't played with, but I only have to deal with them in the afternoon. It's horrible to have to deal with three or four artists who are coming on stage for the first time with only the sound check to run through. That just means that it's fraught with, oh my God, have we done enough? Is it going to be okay? So experience has taught me that the less we have to do at sound checks, the more fun we will have on the gig.
Nice. And when things do go wrong, what's your technique to plaster over those cracks?
Shout. That's when things do go wrong, and we've had a couple of things seriously go wrong. God, there was a classic one.
Is that when the generator was stuck in the...
Well, no, that's not really an issue, because that's just technical, you know. Yeah. I mean, you can't do anything about that. No, I'm talking about music. We did a gig once for Nelson Mandela. Yeah. We did a whole bunch of shows for his 4664 program, and one of them was out in Johannesburg. And we rehearsed this song, quite a big song, with a South African artist. And it was a big song, had been a big hit, but it was also quite an important song for the South Africans. I think it had political meaning, political depth. And I had the Soweto Choir.
Who sang at your wedding.
Right, of course. And everybody else. And the whole point was that we were going to start this up. We had a big, long intro that would... And our artist was going to sing from off stage and walk on singing. So the crowd would go, whoa, it's whoever it was. I can't remember. Mm. It wasn't Johnny Clegg, but it was somebody who had big hits. And the Soweto's were there involved. And the rehearsal was great. Everybody did what they meant to do. It sounded fantastic. The sound check, great. When the gig came around. And, of course, all these shows are always broadcast live out there. So, you know.
Oh, so there's a lot.
Yeah. A lot of people watching. So I count it in. I think starting off with percussion and some chords. And then the singer was due to start. And he didn't sing, and we didn't come in. And these keyboard chords, it wasn't me, I had a second keyboardist so that I could be released and run around. And the keyboard went round the chords, and the singer was due to start. Nothing happened, and I'm thinking, oh, well, what's going to happen? He's not here. And then I started thinking about plan B. Well, I'll get the singer, lead singer from the Soweto's to take over because he's brilliant and he knows everything anyway. And I was just turning to do that when Steve Stroud, the bass player, said, it's in the wrong key.
Oh.
And I went, what? Because I wasn't playing.
Yeah.
And I don't have perfect pitch, so I couldn't tell that it was in the wrong key. And I said, what? And I went over to him, he said, the idiot has started it in D and it's meant to be in A.
Oh, shit.
And I could see the singer who was meant to be walking on over the other side of the stage in the shadows looking at me going, no, this is wrong. All right. I said, okay. So everybody was still playing in D and I got everybody's attention in the middle of the stage. And I said, on my cue, we are going to change to A. You know, it was only important for the guitar and the bass. I don't think the horns had come in yet, but the percussion was all going. So I go, 2, 3, 4, change. So musically, it just sounded like a shifting gear.
Nice.
And there we were. And we all looked at each other and went, Jesus H. Christ. And the singer smiled at me and went, here we go, you know. So that was an occasion when it worked out. There have been occasions when I've had to run around and get everybody's attention and say, okay, we're going to go to a bridge now, or we're going to end the song now because there's a problem, or there's a curfew, and we need to get out of this song. So look at me, and when I go 1, 2, 3, 4, we're going to hit a G chord. 2, 3, 4. Da! Sounds like we know what we're doing. And then I'll count in the song that we're going to go to. So now let me tell you, that takes quite a few years to get comfortable with that.
Mm. One song that I think you joined Dexys Midnight Runners just after they released Come On Eileen, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had debates for years with different musicians about how that song was recorded in regards to the bit where it starts up again and come on, and how everybody is in perfect synchronisation, perfect time, and speeds up. And obviously there was no kind of, like, that was a live recording. How did that band, how are they so tight to do that? Because it's such a perfect take. And I think a lot of musicians would struggle to be so in time and speed up and then straight into it. It's such a perfect recording.
I would say, knowing how Kevin Rowlands works, that, and also the producers, who were, was it Langer, Winstanley or somebody?
I'm not sure, right, okay.
I just think he made them play it a million times before they recorded it, because that's how he was. He had this thing about, if you made a mistake, we go back, start again, which terrified everybody, didn't encourage us at all. And so I think it was muscle memory. Whereas most people will go in, I mean, the opposite of that is Don't Stop Me Now by Queen, which was one take.
Really?
Yeah, and no overdubs. Wow. Only vocals. So, you, and also, who's the, what's the other great big hit that is one take? Since You've Been Gone by Rainbow.
Oh, really?
That's what... Ritchie Blackmore and Cozy Powell hated that song so much that they refused to play it more than once.
And it's probably the song that was most being played that yeah, they played on.
Yeah, exactly. But Rowlands was the other way around. He would, they would just play from morning till night, rehearse, so that they had that stuff. So it, for them, it wasn't a challenge at all, because they had rehearsed. Somebody like me, that would drive me crazy. Mm. Because as far as I'm concerned, as soon as you get it right once, let's move on to the next thing, you know. But they would have done it over again, and they probably may have recorded it over and over again. Simon Kirk, the drummer of Free and Bad Company, mm-hmm. was talking to him the other day about the difference between some kind of then and now. And we were talking about their big hit, All Right Now, 1970, massive hit. And we were talking about the sort of fantastic, iconic guitar solo that Paul Kossoff played on that. And I said, you know, it's one of those solos, you instantly know what it is, who it is, and it's a piece of, you know, music stands on its own, that solo. And he said, yeah, that was take 27. And I went, really? Take 27? He said, yeah. No, actually, I've got it wrong. No, he said, we had 27 takes. And I said to him, I bet you took take three or four. He said, take two.
That's always right, isn't it? You said earlier that, you know, you remember playing pub gigs back in the day, and a lot of bands playing pub gigs, they end up getting in kind of very subtle rivalries with other bands. And I know you once said that you, one of the things you loved about the Freddie tribute gig is there was like not a competitive atmosphere between some of the bands on. When you're at that level you are now, is there still like a little bit of rivalry between different bands? Or is that kind of by and gone?
Do you know what? Yes, but only in a positive way, because everybody wants to shine. Everybody wants to have a good gig. I mean, there used to be nasty things going on back in the old days where the headlining act wouldn't let the support act use all the PA or the lights or keep them at half volume. I mean, that was the kind of thing that was to make the headlining band seem bigger, louder and more fantastic. Hey, that may still go on. I don't know. Maybe it does. But once you get to a certain level, everybody's very sort of supportive and helpful. But when you're on stage, you want to be the best there is. So you're not going to hold back. You know, you're going to give it all guns. And that's what the deal was at Live Aid. Everybody wanted to shine and do well, but not at the expense of somebody else. And it's there was a sign up above the entrance to the stage at Live Aid that said, kill time and you murder success, which was all about not running over, not stealing airtime from the next band. And sadly, a bit of that has gone. The respect that artists should show. Because what happens is this. If you've got a big show that's going out, let's say it's going out on TV, there is a cut-off point and there's a curfew. There are very few shows that are allowed to run over. You may have a 10 o'clock curfew. Now, this has to run right the way back to 5 o'clock in the afternoon if the first band is going on then. Every time somebody runs over, those minutes disappear because the last band on can't just run on another half an hour or an hour. They've still got to end at 10 o'clock. And that's what happens when you're the headliner. You have to have somebody there who's watching the clock and make sure that everybody else is sticking to it. They normally would put in a little bit of run over time in between the bands, say that, let's say you've got 10, 15 minutes in between the band, but they expect you to change over in 5 minutes so that you don't eat all the time up. Well, it happens that people do eat that time up. And sometimes it happens that artists are not conscious of what's happening after them. They're only conscious of themselves in the spotlight. And that could be very disrespectful. And it does upset me as a... In my role as musical director of an actual show, when I'm running it, then I actually bend over backwards to make sure that everybody knows when they're coming off. And I will pull them off if I have to, because I can't bear that disrespect to the other artists. Yeah.
So you mentioned Live Aid there. When you were performing on stage, did you get the scale of what it was at the time? Or was it not another gig, but it was, you know, it was only in retrospect that it's been a big thing.
Yeah, actually, we had no idea. For us, it was business as usual.
Really?
You know, we went on stage, we played the songs. It was a case of, for God's sake, can we remember the edits? That was a case where we had to edit things down because it's
a medley. Yeah.
And we had run it through a day or two before, and it was quite simple. And contrary to what the film depicts, there hadn't been a 2-year break. We'd actually been on the road for 8 months, so we were hot and
match fit.
Match fit. And so having come up with this edited version and timed it and got it right, we were good. We did come off the rails. The end of Hammer to Fall is a complete mess. And I think it was Freddie not paying attention. He was having too much fun. The singer goes off, but it was the end of the song, so there was nowhere for us to go. Yeah. So you will see if you watch it now that it kind of all disintegrates and falls apart.
Doing the vocoder on Radio Gaga, performance.
Yeah.
And that vocoder, does it still exist? Is it the one that you still use today, or is it evolved?
It does exist. It is on the wall of Portsmouth Guildhall, where there's an exhibition that they very kindly allowed me to take over a couple of rooms in their Portsmouth musical experience, and let me put on my crap in it. It's actually quite a fun thing, and we spent a lot of time. My wife Carl sort of curated it, and she's very good at that kind of thing. It's funny, and it's got some great stuff in it. And up on the wall, there are some instruments, including that vocoder.
And when you use a vocoder now, are you singing and playing notes?
Yeah.
So you're not talking the words; you're singing it. And if you were to sing a note, what key is it in, or what pitch is it if you're playing different notes to what you're singing?
I may sing a harmony.
Oh, you can harmonise with it. Oh, okay.
No, yeah, but I might sing a harmony that's relevant to what everybody else is singing.
Oh, okay.
But the vocoder will only put out the notes that I have my fingers on. So let's say if it's a C chord, so the C chord consists of C, E, and G, and that's what will come out through the vocoder, but into a microphone, a regular microphone, I might sing a G. It doesn't matter. I'll just go,
Right.
And in fact, in the early days of Radio Gaga, when it goes radio, radio, that is just vocoder. There's no real vocal part for that. It's only the vocoder. And some bastard, that's the only word I can use. Actually, I think it might be the sound man, recorded me shouting into this. So I'm going, radio, I'm trying to get a strength of vocal in there. And the notes leaving my mouth were irrelevant because the vocoder was giving the notes. What I wanted was the enunciation and the power. So it responds to how strong you sing into it and also how you phrase. So I can smile and make my voice very thin and it will respond to that.
Really?
Or I can go deep like this and it will respond to that. So I can affect the sort of tone of it with my enunciation and projection, but the actual musical notes will be what comes from my fingers. And my vocal mic was on close by and he recorded me shouting and bawling into the vocoder mic and then played it back to him. I thought, yeah, okay, I'll get you.
What concert have you played that you most wish you could have experienced from the audience's perspective?
Yeah, that's funny, that's good. Which concert would I like to watch from the front? Any of the Mandela shows, because I think I'd like to see what it feels like to have that unexpected, what's happening, going to happen next. And I've always been a fan of things that go change, you know, like the jukebox thing. That must come from the 60s because we used to have package shows where you would get six or seven acts on one bill and they would change. I remember, I didn't get to see it, but I heard about it, the Stax show that came across in the mid-60s with Sam and Dave and Otis Redding. And everybody said that's the most exciting show that they ever saw. I saw several package shows. The first package show I saw opened up with a band that I don't remember. And then we had the Amen Corner, who had a couple of number ones at the time, so they were big news. That's Andy Fairweather Alone. Followed by The Nice, which was the original band from Keith Emerson before Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
Oh, right.
And he was a big star, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, The Nice. And then followed by The Move, which was Roy Wood and the band from Birmingham. They were huge stars, had lots of big hits. So these are serious names.
Yeah.
Each one of them could be a headliner in their own right. Mm-hmm. Then there was an intermission. And when we came back, it was Pink Floyd, who had a couple of white sheets up and some oil lamps. This is with Sid Barrett. This is the original Pink
Amazing.
Floyd. And then they went off, and the top of the bill was Jimi Hendrix. Now, I think I paid 7 shillings for that. So we were used to having good value. A year or so later, I went to Southampton. The opening act was the Yardbirds with Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page on guitars.
Nice.
It was a transition period. And then the next on the act were Ike and Tina Turner, Soul Review. And top of bill was the Rolling Stones.
Wow.
So value for money, you know, and I like the idea.
I can see where that seed has been planted for us.
Yeah,
so,
you know, those nights. For me, 3 songs and off, you know. Play your best 3 songs and then hand it over to somebody else.
One thing I'd like you to try and describe, if you can, because I've never experienced this, is you said your first gig was Beatles age 12 and you couldn't hear the songs because the screaming was that loud.
Yeah,
that,
and there were no cases. They only had little tiny Vox 4x12 columns and they may have linked into the house PA system, which would have been only a sort of speaking thing. But to be honest, you couldn't hear. I don't think instruments were mic'd up in those days.
Ah, okay, so it was...
But they had these quite big Vox amps. They call them Super Beetle amps in America, but I think we called them Defiance over here. But they were giant. They were massive. And, you couldn't tell... you couldn't hear what they were singing, but you knew what they were singing almost by the stage dynamics and their body language. When Paul was singing, you knew what kind of song. If it was a fast one... You know, I saw her standing there. If it was a slow one, it was Till There Was You. And they only did like 7 songs.
Yeah.
It's like a 35, 40-minute set. And you knew they were going to end up with Twisted Shout. And the latest single at the time was, I think it may have been I Want to Hold Your Hand, had just come out.
Oh, man, that's
And
classic.
Of course, and every time a song finished, the noise was deafening beyond belief, and it was kind of dropped for a second, and they would count the next song in, and then it would go up again, and it would just stay there. And so, yeah, I mean, but we know now that how fantastic they were live, because they had done their 10,000 hours in Hamburg. So they could sing, they could play, and really they set the bar for everybody.
You and Boomtown Rats at the time that Geldof devised the idea of Live Aid, which you then played with Queen, you said to Geldof it was too mind-boggling an idea to put together. Why was that so difficult to arrange? at that time? What was the landscape like? So why? What were the logistics around that that made it so difficult?
Well, you know, when he first of all, when he said they were going to have an all-day show at Wembley, and I said, God, that would, even that in those days would be take a long time to prepare. But what he wanted to do, his original idea, was to have Wembley and Shea Stadium in New York and have one song from one band and then cut to the other country and have a song from there. And I said, and rely on live broadcasting. And I said, God, you're just asking for trouble. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. That's never going to work. And my heart sank when he said it. But hey, you know, through the force of his character, he made everybody jump on board. And fortunately, he got the best talent, technical talent, on board, as well as musical talent. So the people running the event, making it happen, you know, operating the knobs and putting the plugs in, were the best of the day. And we have to sort of take our hats off to them. It was a technical marvel to have it as problem-free as it was. I know it wasn't completely... I mean, there was issues with the Who's rig. It didn't come on. There were issues with McCartney's mic. But when you think of all the things that could have gone wrong on that show, those are the two things that I really remember as being a major hold-up. You know?
What was the sound like on stage for you?
Probably horrible. But like I say, I'm old school. I don't need much. And if I'm in trouble, I look at the drummer and watch what he's doing. So at least I know, as long as I'm in time, and as long as I can hear the lead vocal, then I know that I'm in the right part of the song. There is one little bit where at the end of the whole thing, Fred and Brian sang this song called "Is This the World We Created?" It's only a little piece, it's only about 2 minutes long, and it involves a keyboard coming in halfway through, which we'd been doing on the tour. And so they were out the front singing, and because of the chaos backstage, my keyboard tech slung up my keyboard onto a little stand in my Jupiter 8, I think it was. And I said, "Where's the monitor?" He said, "There isn't one." So here I am, 30 feet away from them, looking at Fred's mouth and the lips, and I'm actually lip-reading the song and playing along with it. Now, that may be one of the tensest things I've ever done.
Kind of reflected on the fact that if you were to go back like 300 or 400 years and say to someone that there'll be the technology in 300 or 400 years where someone will be able to start a song to 100,000 people, 80,000 people, and you'd be able to create an emotional shift in all of those people at once. You ever reflected on the kind of, not the power around that, but, you know, just before you're starting a song, you know, it might be the bit on Bohemian Rhapsody with piano or something else, where you know for that within 2 seconds you are going to change the emotional state of 80,000 people at your fingertips. Isn't that an incredible thing to consider? Have you ever considered that, reflected on that?
Yeah, but that's the shared experience, isn't it? Because everybody comes with what they know and their knowledge of the songs or whatever, and there will be trigger points, and there are certain parts of certain songs that will reach everybody, maybe in different ways, but knowing that when I start playing ding, 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 as long as I don't mess that first one up, I probably don't have to worry about it because everybody's shouting too much to cover the rest of it. We rely on that in a way. We rely on the fact that, I mean, when John Deacon used to go dum, 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 4 bass notes, 5 bass notes, whatever, and the place goes crazy. Mm. But you rely on that. You know, and you know that's going to be an emotional win. And you can relax because people, they got it, you know, the audience get it all the time. So it's when you do something new, different, or something, and they all look at you blankly. I call it the meerkat look, who will look it from side to side going, what the hell is this, you know?
How do you not get bored of playing the same songs, despite how amazing they are? Because that can happen in bands.
We don't do enough, although we have been touring quite a lot lately. We never do too much. We've worked it out that about 6 weeks is enough for us to start getting over it. At the end of 6 weeks, we're desperate not to see each other and not to play those songs. And then it's time for a break. And then if you have a month or two off, when you come back, it's you're off, you're ready. I mean, if we did it, I mean, that's probably a lesson that young bands haven't learnt, because you get there, you get your hit. The world wants to see you. You travel around the world and you may tour for 18 months of 2 years. By the end of that, you band sped up,
yeah,
because they can't bear the sight of each other. And the smallest thing becomes the biggest thing. And that's when you end up with travelling in different buses or staying, you know, and whatever, not talking to each other. You need to avoid that. And I think it was, who was it? Once said, the band Soft Cell, who rose to meteoric fame with Tainted Love, they had a couple of years when they were it, you know, they were the biggest thing, and they came back off their world tour and broke up. And years later, the keyboard player said, yeah, we did a big world tour and we came back and broke up. We probably just needed a holiday.
Yeah. And the problem is now, though, a lot of bands have to tour to make their income.
Yeah.
And so it's actually a bit of a strange dynamic. I know people are in that very, very boat at the moment. You don't want to split up, but they're sick of each other.
Yeah.
But that's the only way they can make the income, because they're not selling records.
You have to be aware that, you know, if you're travelling together, you're on stage together, you see each other. That's why when we have a day off, I will often go off and do something on my own, totally, just so that I can
escape.
Be out of the bubble, escape. So when you come back together 24, 36 hours later, something to talk about, what you did, what you saw, and you weren't seeing them. And everybody feels the same. You know, this is not an unusual thing. You have to force yourself to do other things now and then, just to allow yourself to reboot and not succumb. Also, back in the day, of course, with alcohol, drugs or whatever, there was lots of that going on. Not now. And not even alcohol so much, because if I drink too much, I can't remember the bloody music. So.
When, you know, you're an incredibly experienced musician, you've been there and done it all. When was the last time you thought, oh, God, I can't play that too? That part is too difficult for me to play.
Yeah, tricky. I might be getting there now, actually. It might be coming up. I'm just turning 68. And every now and then I have to sort of test myself to see if I can do what I expected to do. And on the last tour, I had a couple of pieces of music that I think stretch my somewhat limited abilities. And if I can do it, you have to warm up into it, but it's my test, my litmus paper, if you like.
Interesting.
A couple of pieces where I think, oh my God, it's gone, I can't play this. And then I run through it a couple of times and it comes back.
It comes back, that's good. What's your thoughts on the likelihood eventually that there'll be hologram concerts? And how would you feel about that kind of thing? So, you know, I watched Bohemian Rhapsody, a performance that you did with Queen a few years ago. And I think it started with Freddie playing it on a screen and then you kind of joined in and it was synchronised beautifully. There's only one stage away from that where it's not on a screen and there's a hologram, and that has started happening. Where would you sit on something like that?
I don't think you can turn back progress, and I think people would welcome that. There's going to be a whole audience of people out there that never saw Mercury in the flesh, too young, and they would go along to see a hologram of him running across the stage and playing it, and who cares? Yeah, why not? I mean, for me, there's nothing... I'm not snobbish about anything, apart from people pretending that it's live when it's not. And obviously, if it's a hologram, you know, it's not live. So it is an entertainment. I mean, what's the difference between a hologram and a screen? Yeah, I mean,
and
I think let's go with it. Let's enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. So having been in the music industry for, you know, 40 years or so, How do you think the music industry has changed you as an individual? Having gone in one into the industry and now at the other end of the industry, how has it changed you as a person?
Has it changed me as a person? Well, yeah, I'm not sure. My experiences have changed me. Hopefully, maybe I should be more tolerant. Hopefully I'm more tolerant. I know sometimes I'm not. But I don't think the music industry as such... I mean, I find it astounding, actually. Yeah, come to think of it. I'm shocked at the way things have turned on their heads in terms of before you would tour to back up a recording that you would release, and the record company would support you with promotion and maybe some actual money to help cover expenses, tour support it was called. Mm-hmm. That is now totally on its head. Any piece of music that you record is virtually worthless because it's the moment it's on, from the day it came out, I said the internet will be the downfall of the Western world. And I sincerely believe that. I think it's Facebook and social media is destroying our social fabric and the way we relate to each other. It's half the problem with the division and the disrespect you get. I have nothing to do. I do not do Facebook. I do not anything.
Yeah.
And an email that you get from me, you're lucky if you get it. Because I actually don't want to be that invaded, and people shouldn't be invaded. You know, I don't want to know what my friends are having for breakfast. You know, I'm not interested. And with the music, at the moment I record or do anything and it goes onto the web, it's free because you've got to rely on the goodwill of people to pay you for something. Spotify gives you nothing. And I mean, someone like, who was the biggest selling artist at the moment? Ed Sheeran.
Yeah.
They say, you know, he's got billions of downloads, but he makes bugger all from it.
Yeah.
Fortunately for him, he does very well from his live shows. So now the record companies want a part of your live performance, which to
really?
Me... Oh, yeah. Before they give you a deal, you have to sign away a percentage of your touring income. That is absolutely ludicrous and makes me so mad that the artists... I mean, there's always been this thing about artists being taken advantage of because everybody signs a really crap contract at the beginning of their career because they're just so desperate to get a shot. And then they become massive and they realise they've signed away... way too much, and they spend all their careers trying to get it back. And that there was a time when, and the record companies should be ashamed of themselves because of this, when an artist would sign a deal, he would get an advance, let's say 100 grand, I'm just taking the figure out of the air, to make a record. So then he'd go into the studio and he would make an album, which the record companies would then release. The 100 grand that they advanced him, they would take out of the royalties that come in. So they get their money back before the artist gets paid. So he's going to make 100 grand. And then they will give him royalties from that. And the master tapes that he recorded, they own. So the artist is paying for everything, paying for the recording. And that was the whole thing with Prince back in the 80s and 90s with Warner Brothers. And he had a thing where he wrote Slave on his
That's right.
on his face. And really, that is the worst case. I mean, it's criminal.
And then he gave an album away for free.
You produce something, I make you pay for it, and then I own it. How does that work?
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't make sense. The morality of that is immorality is unbelievable. So I'm glad that that's all gone away. But of course, with the internet, music is free because young people really don't care about paying for music. They don't expect to. They think it's just like anything. It's just so the hours and days and months that you may spend creating your masterpiece is worthless the moment you put it up.
So when I asked a moment ago about how the music industry has changed you, one thing that I'm sure you're aware of, but maybe you're not, is how do you deal with the fact that people treat you differently? Because they do. When I was at Shepherd's Bush, it was like, Spike's over there, Spike's over there. Oh, we're going to go and speak to Spike. It's a really, really big deal. That must be a strange thing to experience.
Well, hopefully my parents brought me up to not be too affected by that kind of stuff. But I tell you, I had been stood next to very famous people who, when they walk down the street, other people will shout at them, "Hey, it's so-and-so, yo," you know, a wave and thumbs up, and start singing their song, or come over and engage them in conversation like they're their best friends and they know them. And the reactions to that can be varied. You know, some people react to it very well. Other people are grumpy and want to be left alone. But the thing is, if you are very distinguished and you walk down the street and people recognize you, I'm afraid that's what you signed up for. Mm. So put on your dark glasses, put on your ball cap, wear a scarf over your nose, and walk down the high street, you know?
Does it impact you? You must sense it from other people coming to talk to you. You must sense it.
Yeah, I do. And I try not to be ungracious, but sometimes I can be tired. And actually, I'll tell you my favourite.
Go for it.
Famous story. It involves some expletives, so you might have to...
You can say whatever you want.
It was on I think it must have been a Queen of Paul Rogers tour. And it was, I should never forget, it was leaving the baseball stadium, or whatever it was, in Miami, Florida. And people will gather around the backstage, outside the stage door as you're leaving. And God bless them, they're standing there for hours, and they just want to get hello and get something signed. So we were sort of bustling out to get on the transport. And sometimes they were, you know, they stick forward a program for you to sign, other grubby bit of paper, sometimes a ticket. Sometimes they want their arm. Sometimes it's a young lady, she might want something else signed. I mean, you know, one hates to disappoint. Anyway, so we were coming out, and this was all going on, and I had a black Sharpie felt tip pen, and so I was signing whatever was stuck in front of me. I just signed because we were surrounded by people, and so you don't want to disappoint it. And we had a minute, and I was signing, you know, Spike and on this and that and the other, and then somebody put a hand out in front of me, and I thought, "Keep rocking, Spike, cross, cross, cross." I looked up, and this guy looked at his hand, he looked at me, and he said, "Hey, motherfucker, I'm homeless, give me a dollar."
Oh, dear. Did you?
Well, at that point, I was pushed onto the bus. I'm going, so embarrassed.
What was the biggest misconception about Freddie Mercury?
Good, I don't know.
So what was the Freddie Mercury that we didn't see necessarily, either in the film or, you know, in public eye?
See, the thing is, Freddie Mercury has been studied so much over the years that I don't think there is a hidden side to him anymore. I mean, it's well known that he was a very private and shy person. And, that, you know, I think it was on the film or in documentaries where he grew up being very aware that his teeth were an issue. But I don't know whether it's true that he chose not to have them fixed because it would affect his voice. I'm not sure whether that's true or not. I'm not aware of that being anything. But his mannerisms was that he would hide his teeth, and sometimes when he would laugh, he would cover his mouth I suppose that's something you develop as a child. He was extraordinarily amusing.
In what way?
Well, he was funny. He had a cutting wit, and he liked to laugh. And because I was only involved with 2 years of touring from 84 to 86, the start of the Works tour in August 84 through to the end of Magic tour at Nebworth. In the latter, after Live Aid and after the sort of serious upgrade of their standing in the world, it did get to the point where he couldn't go out in public anymore. So we, being aware of that, would invite us, the band and me, up to his suite just to hang out and party. You know, And we do it because it was, we felt, it wasn't that we felt obliged. Actually, I quite enjoyed it. And we knew that that would be the only kind of real socialising he would get. Otherwise, it's on the plane, train or whatever the next day in another show. And then for him, it was just a bit of a meat grinder in terms of show, sleep, eat, show, sleep, eat, travel. So he didn't get any fun. But he loved to play Scrabble. And he loved to play, I think, I don't know if it was me that introduced, it may have been me who introduced Trivial Pursuit, or whether we all got it at the same time, because that was the game of choice. And it was very popular in the mid-80s. So,
was he good at it?
Well, the thing about Trivial Pursuit is... it's about all-round knowledge, and it can really catch you out. Like, you think you know everything, and then somebody says, who won the FA Cup in 1958? I mean, you know, really? I mean, that's designed to bring you down. So we had fun with that, and he liked it, and he was very competitive. And there were a lot of laughs. So I do remember him having fun and enjoying, and he liked to challenge, and he liked to drink wine, and we were chatting a couple of nights. I sat up and chatted with him just about his life and how he coped. And he was very sort of like philosophical and resigned to what he'd signed on for, you know, signed on for fame and fortune and everything that goes with it.
What was the biggest compliment he gave you as a musician?
That very fact that he allowed me to come down and play his piano.
Oh.
Because I don't know... Maybe he had done that before with my predecessors. I guess he must have. But there were, I had a couple of occasions in that show, the Magic Show, when we did the little rock and roll medley, Tutti Frutti. He would let me play. Because I didn't have a real keyboard up where I was. I had a couple of emulators and Jupiter 8s, and they're not great for playing piano parts. They don't sound like piano parts anyway in those days. Not like you get today. You know, the Korg I use sounds great, and as a piano keyboard, so it plays like a piano.
And did you play his Live Aid? His piano? Yeah, you did. That was a crazy
little... came down. Yeah. And so I would come down for Tutti Frutti and also Crazy Little Thing. And I think there is one bit of footage, so I must dig it out, where it may have been Live at Budapest, or I don't know. Where he came over to the piano, and while I was banging away during the guitar solo, he started doing a little Richard thing next to me. And at that moment I thought, hey, Mum, Freddie Mercury's playing piano with me, you know. So, but that was a moment. So, and that was probably the nicest compliment, and the fact that he let me do that, because he could have said, stay back there, stay in your corner. You know?
At the end of the Nebworth gig, John Deacon threw his bass across the stage. If you're aware of that, have you seen that? Oh,
he's probably drunk.
Is that something he did? There's a lot of questions around why he did that.
Do you know what? I'm not aware. This is the first I've ever heard of it.
I'll find the YouTube video. I'll show you.
Yeah, do that. But I do know that he may have had a tequila or two or something. so that would have been because he's thinking, "Yay, it's over." I don't think he was very happy traveling as much as we did at that point of his life. I think he was kind of a little bit annoyed with travelling. It got to him. So I would say that was probably in relief.
And the last time you saw him was the We Will Rock You premiere or opening night, is that right?
Yeah, they wouldn't let him in. Didn't know who he was.
Really?
Yeah, well, I don't know what the deal was, but you can imagine opening night, it was pretty chaotic. And I'm sure that they would have had his name on a list somewhere. Thankfully, it wasn't my job, but I did see him. He had a problem getting in, which he was pretty annoyed about, and I sat down and talked to him. We are the same age. He's only about 10 weeks older than me or something. And we also shared a love of black soul music, American music, which we kind of, I don't know, that was our sort of meeting point. That's what that's what we talked about. And during those tours, I would go out with him quite a lot in search of music and fun to be had. And he was always up for an outing. So I felt friendly and relatively close to him during those tours. But I knew that you know, they'd had a long and up and down career, and there was always something going on between the four of them, which I wasn't privy to. But I think by the time Nebworth came around, he needed a long holiday.
And do you think that when we talked about how the music industry can affect someone, do you think the industry has got something to answer for in the way he's been very reclusive in those years, or is it just completely independent of that?
No, I don't think that's got anything to do with it. Queen made their money, still do. He gets his share of it. You know, I don't think he's been badly treated at all. I think he has other issues about travelling around the world playing. I mean, I think he just grew out of it, you know. His life moved on. Because don't forget, they started as students, and we all did, and you've got youthful vigour and you love it. And then some people move on. It doesn't stay with them all their lives. Now, it stayed with me, mainly because I can't do anything else, but also I haven't lost the taste for creating something and getting up there and playing. For me, it's about the most fun you can have. It's being on stage with a bunch of people that you like and whose abilities you respect.
And one of the people you did look up to very much was Stevie Wonder, and you played with Stevie Wonder, is that right?
Yeah. God, that was a moment. And that was the second Mandela birthday party, which sadly he was too ill to attend. It was just before he died. His 90th we did in Hyde Park, his 91st we did in Radio City, New York. And we were the house band, but there were two artists that insisted that they would be using their own band. That was Aretha Franklin. Our horn section got to play with her, I didn't get to play with her. And Stevie Wonder. There's two stories here. The first story was, as ever, there's never enough time to sound check and rehearse all the artists that are on there, you know. So the band has to play as though the artist is there. Rehearse as though the artist is there. And sometimes we have to sound check and we go on stage never having played the song with the artist. Now,
I'm feeling anxious just thinking about it.
And that's part of the deal. We just have to make sure we do our homework, and invariably the artist will send along an MD or a representative, a musical director, to go through it with us and make sure that we have the arrangement down pat so that the artist can walk on stage. And the best example of that was with Queen Latifah, who I always thought of as a rap artist, but she's a really, really good singer. She's a really great singer, in fact. And she chose to do this song that she had performed on Broadway from a musical called Hairspray. And it was a very emotive, heart-thumping ballad. Now, it had my heart thumping because I thought, we've got to get this right. And anyway, she walked on stage and she gave the most amazing performance. And the band rose to it. And it really was a moment where it all came together. And we were hung together with spider's web and, you know what I mean, with no rehearsal with her, just what we'd learned and what we'd been told. So during the course of that day, we had to stop and said, OK, Stevie Wonder's going to come on stage and do his sound check with his band. You all have to leave the building.
And I turned building?
Around, yeah. Wow. I turned around and said to the stage manager, you can fuck off. Because we've come a very long way. We're very tired. I've got another 15 artists to run through and I am not leaving the building. And he said, all right. I guess I must have given him my serious voice and face. And he said, oh, okay, you can sit down there. So all of us, the SAS, went and sat in the front row at Radio City Music Hall and watched Stevie Wonder soundcheck for an hour. I can tell you it was the most exhilarating musical thing I've ever done. Almost brought me to tears. And he doesn't rehearse what he's going to do that night. He just plays songs. And whatever comes into his mind, and it might be something of his, it might be something he just thought of that day, it might be somebody else's. It's just a constant musical stream of consciousness. And he'll start something, and he did a Herbie Hancock piece, and he did a Chick Corea piece. And the band, who of course have to live like this, and his musicians are really, you know, they're all gods. And they just hear the first three notes of what he's playing, and they're off. And so for an hour, this never-ending torrent. He never got tired of anything. He'd just do it, he'd sing, and then he'd stop, and then he'd start something else. And At the end of that hour, I was exhausted by the sheer musical talent that was coming off that stage. I thought, this is fantastic. And then, of course, on the show, he came on and we stayed... Did we stay in, the horn section stayed in position to play with him, and everybody else had to move out of the way for his band, except me, because my keyboards couldn't be moved. And they rolled out his grand piano and clavinet or whatever in, right in front of me. And so I just stayed there. I just sat where, right next to him. I was far away from him as I am from you now. He was facing the other way playing. And what's his bass player? Nathan Watts is his bass player, and his MD. And I'm just sat there, keeping quiet, hoping nobody bollocks me or sends me off. Stevie goes through his songs and plays a couple of classic hits and something new and whatever. And he gets to the end, and he does his kind of a speech for Nelson Mandela. Then they start off singing Happy Birthday to you, Happy Birthday.
Yeah.
And he starts, and I'm looking, and I look at Nathan Watts, and he looked at me, and he just nodded, go on, you're in. And so I joined in, hoping not to cock it up. Just to be in his... He is such a sort of musical tour de force genius, of playing, singing and writing, that you cannot help but feel his power when he's on stage.
So, final question. What's your most important piece of music memorabilia? So the house is burning down, everyone's safe, family's good. What's the thing that you're going to grab?
We're sat here
around a lot of guitars on the
wall.
Yeah,
these are all quite new. If the house was burning down right at this moment, I would, for my 50th birthday... the band clubbed together and bought me a John Lennon acoustic replica, reissue. I would probably grab that because of all its meanings. But I've got some stuff down in the exhibition in Portsmouth.
Of course.
And the Fender Telecaster that kind of took me from being a schoolboy guitar player to being a professional guitarist. That would probably have great meaning. And then there's the dressing gown that I wore backstage after the show on the very first Queen gig.
Oh, nice. You still got that. Yeah. Good stuff. Okay, and so upcoming, so we got some SAS gigs coming up,
Yes, we have. We've got two shows in Southampton, but they're sold out. And I think there are half a dozen tickets left for the show that we're doing at Guildford G Live on Saturday, the 7th December. It's going to be a fantastic night. With who have we got? Chris Thompson from Man from Man's Earth Band, the man who sang the very first song on the very first gig back in 1994. So this is our 25th anniversary. So I'm trying to include, some people who were around for the first gig, as well as newer friends. Also from that first gig, Kiki D.
Nice.
Very a great singer. So we got the fabulous Tom Robinson from 2468 Motorway fame, who's also now a very renowned broadcaster on Six Music. He's great, great performer. We've got Fish from Marillion.
Nice.
I've just announced that we've got Roachford and Mike Rutherford from Mike and the Mechanics.
Nice.
They've signed up this week. And we've got the fabulous Madeline Bell, who is
legend.
Queen Soul in my book, and it's one of the great talents that we have. And I always say the world is divided into two kinds of people: those who absolutely adore Madeline Bell, and those who haven't seen her yet. And of course, the fabulous Fabba Girls, Susie and Zoe.
So thank you so much, Spike, for sharing your wisdom, your guidance. You've played on performances that are going to be watched for generations and generations to come. So well done for securing your musical legacy. Thanks for sharing your wisdom, and thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
All right. It's a pleasure.
For For more episodes featuring Tony Visconti on recording David Bowie's Black Star, we recorded that just days before Bowie passed. Jamie Moses on 10 Years in Queen. We got Gem Archer from Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds and Oasis. Russ Pritchard from the same band too. Richard Forster of Guns N' Roses. Clive Deamer of Radiohead. Billy Burnett of Fleetwood Mac. And many, many more, including Stuart Lee. Go to thestagedeathpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter at thestagedeathpod. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestagedeathpodcast. Go to our Instagram page, search for the Stage Left Podcast on there. Stage Left is all one word, where you'll see photos of all the behind-the-scenes shows. Get in touch with us as well. Drop us an email to simo.cs@gmail.com. So that's simo.cs@gmail.com, where we can give you some details about our private dinner in our lounge in London with Mo Pleasure coming up on the 22nd of December. Thanks for listening.